disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest right now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't.
My name is Crystal Stella Becerril, and I'm a striking tenant at 1234 Pacific in Brooklyn, New York.
And my name is Maxwell Paparella, and I'm Stella's neighbor at 1234 Pacific Street. I'm also on strike.
Well, just to kind of get us started, just take us, I know you've all been talking about this a lot, but if you can just take us back to the beginning. I mean, obviously, this is a big step. There's been a lot of talk online and, you know, just between people that rant about something like this, but take us back to the beginning. How did you actually come to this point where you're on rent strike?
Right off the bat, we have a tenants association. We've had a tenants association for about a year and a half. So that obviously was a big component in being able to launch a successful rent strike. And by successful, I mean, we have more than 50% of the building on board. We have about 2/3 of the building on strike. As of April 1st. And so that was, you know, that was an important element to the work that we've been able to do over the last few weeks. But really the conversation around a rent strike started after our efforts to create a building mutual aid sort of system. And, you know, so state of emergency was declared in New York, I want to say the 18th of March. And within a few days, we, you know, those of us who are most engaged within the tenants association, said, hey, we should set up a mutual aid in the building. We know we've got some older tenants and there might be tenants who are, dealing with underlying health conditions, and let's build a mutual aid, group here within the building so that people don't feel alone or don't feel like they're handling this pandemic on their own. So immediately after the state of emergency was declared, we launched that, and we have a building email list, and we let people know, that we were putting together this mutual aid, network in the building. And if people wanted to volunteer to be on it, as people for their neighbors or do anything else for their neighbors, they could reach out and we could put them on the mutual aid list. And then we physically printed that mutual aid list with the phone numbers, of the people on it, and distributed it to all of our neighbors under the door to make sure that people have a number they can call if they need anything. So that was how we got started. And then obviously things escalated quite quickly. With the crisis. So within a few days, within, you know, a week of launching this mutual aid, network in the building, we realize, oh, we're headed into something way bigger than any of us could have imagined. What do we do about this? Some of our neighbors had already lost their jobs, or been furloughed. And those of us who are already precarious, or people who are already precariously employed, were like, okay, this might be coming down the road for me too. And so, things just moved really quickly to keep up with the situation and how quickly it was escalating, particularly here in New York, where you went from early March, you know, a handful of confirmed cases to by the end of the month, hundreds of deaths a day. So just things escalated so quickly, and so did our efforts in order to match the magnitude of the crisis. So I'll let Maxwell jump in and add more there.
As we were hearing back from people about what kind of mutual aid was needed and what they were concerned about moving into this crisis. Our neighbors, you know, other than the obvious health concerns, were most worried about paying rent on the first of the month. A lot of us were quickly out of work, as a result of the crisis, and, had significant lost income, and, you know, often also our expenses had gone up because the grocery supply chain has been disrupted. And so groceries are now more expensive. Medical care has always been expensive and is now something that, we all are very aware that we need to have, that we, you know, are supposed to have something saved for. And so it quickly became clear that a lot of us were not going to be able to pay the rent on April 1st. And more of us were on board to withhold our rent in solidarity with those of our neighbors who couldn't pay. So we were able to start slipping flyers under our neighbors' doors. And, you know, we had an email and a phone list already for some of the folks that we live with. And so we're able to get in touch with people and see what their situation was, of course, and then see what their interest in a tactic like a rent strike was. And as Stella said, we had been organized for about a year and a half prior to the crisis, and a rent strike is something that we had discussed before because it is the only way that some of our neighbors had been able to exact repairs from the landlord in their units is by withholding rent on an individual basis. And so we had talked about a larger action like that. But we, you know, just never had enough buy-in on among our neighbors in order for people to feel like that was going to be the best way forward. But then, of course, you know, what seems radical in March by April is necessary. And so we, undertook a rent strike with 2/3 units participating, looking to have even more, of our neighbors on board by May.
You know, one of the things that people are hearing, in this talk about the rent strike and just, you know, the general state of renting right now under the coronavirus pandemic is there's just this constant kind of refrain from people that, like, oh, you're just hurting, you know, a tiny old, you know, grandma that owns this. This is all she has. And just kind of like that image of the landlord as kind of like just another working person. And I'm just curious, like, did you all have those issues kind of getting this thing going? And also just kind of like, what's the reality of what you're up against?
Yeah, the reality in New York State is that most people's landlord is a management company, and is, you know, like a very much a large scale, profit seeking enterprise. They seem not to feel themselves to be so much in the business of providing people with a safe and comfortable home as they are in extracting just as much value out of real estate as they can in as short a time as possible. And, you know, as we've seen in the past, 20 or 30 years in the city, that involves quickly moving people out of their homes, displacing huge swaths of New Yorkers. Often, you know, for sure, is a big piece in creating the homeless crisis that we now have in the city and elsewhere. And so, for instance, our landlord, who bought the building, I think about 15 years ago now, is a landlord who owns 50 buildings in New York City. That's a real estate portfolio that's valued at $87 million. His name is Isaac Schwartz. He makes a regular appearance every year on the Public Advocates list of the 100 worst landlords in New York City. Last year he was number 16, I believe. And so we know that our landlord, and that, you know, most people's landlord, is this type of slumlord in New York, and that they are the we think that these people are best positioned to take to absorb some of the financial fallout of this moment, of the economic crisis that's accompanying the COVID-19 public health crisis. And, you know, with an $87 million portfolio with 50 buildings in New York, moving very quickly in those buildings to deregulate rent stabilized units, which was possible until the Tenant Protection Act of 2019. And, you know, again, displacing working people, bumping units up to market rate, and really, price gouging tenants in New York, making it extremely difficult to live here. You know, we knew before this before COVID-19 happened, that there was a housing crisis in New York, and now it's a crisis inside of a crisis, of course. And so the question is whether we allow the cycles of displacement that already exist in our communities to accelerate in this moment, because landlords are easily able to identify the least resourced of their tenants and evict them after this crisis is over, after the housing courts reopen and they're able to do that, or whether we can stand together as tenants and refuse to let business as usual continue.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. You know, I don't think, perhaps it's different in different parts of the country, but certainly here in New York, where 70% of people are renters and not homeowners, and even those who are homeowners, like single home homeowners, are fewer than, like Maxwell said, the majority of people rent from management companies whose portfolios are similar to that of Isaac Schwartz, who's our landlord. And you know, the thing is, it's been very, very clear over the last 4 weeks, 6 weeks, that the city and state have landlords' backs. They are prepared to protect the property owning class of the city at the expense of the working class, the renting class, and we're saying that. Well, one, that's obviously not fair. And, you know, I think it's really obscene how, people are constantly, or the powers that be are constantly, sort of chastising, the working class. Oh, you should be prepared. You know, you should have 3 months of rent saved up in case of an emergency like this. And I don't know a single person in New York City that makes enough money to save, right? Everyone that I know, is just living paycheck to paycheck because the city is so unlivable at this time, at this moment, at this point in time, after, you know, 20, 30 years of like neoliberal policy after neoliberal policy that has stripped away any of the like remaining rights and protections that tenants and workers and other people, in New York have had, have won through, you know, through hard struggle. And so, you know, now we're in this situation. And there's no going back to the status quo. There's no going back to how things were. Things aren't going to return to normal or business as usual. And you know, just to be clear, the norm, what used to be the status quo, sucked to begin with for working class folks in the city and across the country. It sucked for renters. It sucked for most New Yorkers. But even that, like, we understood it. We had sort of, for the most part, figured out how to navigate it. I mean, poorly, we were just getting by. A lot of people weren't even getting by. We're on the streets. But there's no going back to even that system that existed, that sucked, that was insufficient, that was cruel. Like, there's no going back to that. And so going forward, there's one of two options that's going to be, you know, meeting us or waiting for us at the end of the crisis. And one will either be we win more rights and protections for tenants and working class people in the city, or the little that we had left gets completely stripped away, and the city like just becomes even an even more unlivable like place than it already had been in the last few decades. And you know, it's scary going into the unknown of like not knowing what's going to come down 3 months from now, 3 weeks from now, even, right? But I think it's also an opportunity for us to help write what comes after this. You know, like if we don't come out of COVID-19 with better renter protections and rights, I mean, if we don't come out of COVID-19 with universal healthcare, like there's something deeply wrong with the system, and COVID-19 is exposing all of that. And we have a rare opportunity to actually organize ourselves to help write what happens after this.
Do you all want to talk about the process of going on rent strike, just getting everybody on the same page? You've already kind of touched on that already, but I don't know if you want to talk about that at all too.
Yeah, I think we could talk a little bit about, I guess, what some of the conversations look like, right? Like, obviously, Going on a rent strike is not an easy decision to make. It's becoming, I think, increasingly easier since the situation has gotten that much, you know, scarier across the country, you know, in the last few weeks. But it's still not an easy decision to make for most people, because we all know that if your housing situation is insecure or unstable, that jeopardizes everything else in your life, your work, your family, your health. So it's really a foundational piece for everyone. And so deciding to do something that could potentially threaten it, but the risks are pretty serious, is not an easy decision for people to make. And so, of course, there's naturally a lot of questions and some hesitation. We spent a significant amount of time having conversations with our neighbors, listening to their concerns, being very clear and transparent about the risks, but also being very clear and transparent about the fact that, like I said, we don't know what's coming down the line. And the only way that we'll be in a position to protect ourselves and each other is by doing something that's a collective action, right? And that the benefit is proportional to the risk. So if the risk wasn't high, then what we could expect to win from something like a rent strike would not be as high, right? And so what we're looking here to do with a rent strike is to, one, protect the most vulnerable amongst us right now, but also really to protect ourselves down the line, right? Like, that's the whole point of solidarity, that I see myself in your struggle in some way, shape, or form. So even those of us who may still be employed right now, we may not be employed in 6 weeks, right? And so right now I'm striking in solidarity with a neighbor who has lost their job, has lost all form of income. But I'm also striking for myself 6 weeks down the road if, you know, I'm in a position where I've also lost my income. And so, again, being very transparent about the risks and about the unknowns, and also being very transparent about, like, this is a rare opportunity to, like, help shape what the outcome of this is going to look like. And doing lots of follow-up, you know, it's like that's the non-glamorous part of any struggle. It's like just follow-up, answering people's questions and exploring some of their concerns, and, you know, keeping them up to date with where the rest of the building are. Because, you know, that's a very real thing. People are like, well, I'll sign on if, you know, once you reach 50% buy-in from the rest of the building, I'm in, right? The hard part is if everyone feels that way, getting people to hit that 50% mark. So it involved a lot of follow-up. It involved a lot of, like, again, listening to people and building trust, right? Like, if you don't have trust going into something like this, you're just not going to get the buy-in necessary. People need to know that we have each other's back. And that's the most foundational piece in something like a rent strike is having that trust in each other and people knowing they're going into something that is scary with people that they know, like, they can count on.
Yeah, I don't have much to add to that. I think that's exactly right. I mean, maybe the only other thing I would say is that this is in some ways a very difficult moment to organize in, because we don't have any of our usual toolkit at our disposal, in a sense. I mean, we're not able to be in the streets with our neighbors and others. We're not able to even, you know, go to their doors and have a conversation with them necessarily. But we are able, I think, to speak to everyone about a situation that we can agree has is of the utmost urgency. And you know, as I said, the something that seemed maybe like a radical step might have seemed like a radical step a couple of months ago is now just what is necessary for people to feel secure in their homes, to, you know, experience some degree of health and food security, is, you know, we don't want anyone making the choice. We don't want anyone being faced with the choice of, Am I going to buy groceries this week? Am I going to, receive the medical care that I need, or am I going to make rent? And so that's been really starkly illustrated for everyone in this moment that it's a problem that a lot of us already deal with on a month to month basis, but it's a problem that a lot more people are dealing with in the months of April and May and probably June and July, 2020. So there was, it was possible to organize very broadly. And maybe to your question at the beginning, I mean, we're certainly not alone in this. And that is a huge, that's huge to understand that by May 1st, you know, in April, thousands and thousands of people, by some estimates, I think something like a third of the country didn't pay rent. And, by May, we think that'll be, you know, many millions more, just in New York State alone. And so we are in solidarity with every tenant who's not paying rent this month. And we know that by organizing broadly, by organizing, not just by building by building, but block by block and neighborhood by neighborhood and eventually city by city, we can make our demands most forcefully, to the people who don't like to, remember that they work for tenants, that 70% of New Yorkers are tenants, and that is the constituency of Governor Cuomo. And as long as he's listened to, the real estate interests that fund his reelection campaigns every couple years, he will be reminded on May 1st, I think, that he works at the behest of tenants.
We're going to talk about May 1st in a second here, but I know you all have done a lot of media stuff and you've been obviously very public about the rent strike. Can you describe for us as much as you possibly know, like how extensive is the rent strike in New York right now? It seems like across the country there's a mix between people that have gone on rent strike starting in April that just flat out can't pay. People like yourselves who have gone public, and then also people that are actively organizing right now that are kind of gearing up for May 1st. I'm just curious if you can just kind of, you know, tell us a little bit about, you know, the movement that's in place right now and how big is this thing currently, like in the middle of April?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we are in touch with the Housing Justice for All Coalition. And that's a upstate, downstate, you know, New York-wide coalition of tenants groups and advocacy groups. And they were instrumental in winning the Tenant Protection Act of 2019, just last year. And now they're really at the center of this movement to demand rent cancellation in New York and really to demand a homes guarantee. They're part of a nationwide campaign, to really center housing as a human right. And so we know through them and through other, you know, we're also involved in some of the member organizations, the Crown Heights Tenant Union. We are a member building, we're one of the locals of the Crown Heights Tenant Union. So we happen to, you know, we do know that there will be a lot of buildings on strike in May 1st that we're building towards, a large scale action. Essentially a general rent strike, the kind of, the likes of which hasn't been seen in the city since probably the 1930s, you know, like, hundreds, if not thousands of buildings in well-organized public, very intentional rent strikes with demands at the state level. So, yeah, maybe that's what I'd say about that. And if Stella has anything to add, please.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't have like concrete numbers, but like Maxwell said, it's obviously like a upstate, downstate, effort that's being, led in through a coalition of different organizations coming together, that had previously been doing really good work again around centering housing as a human right. And now, that struggle has come front and center during this crisis. And so, you know, I wouldn't be able to give you a figure or even a ballpark of like how many buildings in the city are organizing at the moment. But increasingly people are having these conversations, in their buildings and with their neighbors. And because the difference is, you know, we know that a third of Americans didn't pay rent on April. And that was simply like a practical thing. Like, I just don't have the money because I was laid off or like I've lost my income. And so the difference being going into May is that like many more millions of people are not going to be able to pay rent on May 1st, more than weren't able to pay on April 1st. And the difference is going to be if you just miss your payment on your own and you're sitting in your apartment scared about what happens when the housing courts reopen, versus your conversations with your neighbors who are probably also in a similar situation, and you all can have each other's back and be, you know, be standing together going into what the next few months are gonna bring. So the, you know, organizing yourselves, organizing your building and your neighbors and your neighborhoods and your cities, is gonna be the difference between, you know, very scary next few months, or very scary next few months, but doing it with other people, and knowing that they have your back and knowing that, you know, you're all in this together, like seriously together. And so, yeah, I think I'll leave it there because I know we're going into the May 1st stuff in a second. They're not doing it nearly enough. I mean, they're not really doing anything. Like you said, like Maxwell said, you know, Cuomo is friends with the real estate, business here. And, you know, I think at a press conference a few weeks ago, he said, well, you know, they've got to pay rent too. And they've got, you know, like talking about them the same way that you started the conversation of like, well, you know, what about the grandmother who's the landlord of this building and that's all they have? And it's like, that's not the reality. That's not most landlords in the city. And yet they continue to sort of like, prop up this fake image of a landlord here in New York. And like, won't anyone think of the poor landlords who own 50 buildings in an $87 million portfolio? And so we know that the city and state hasn't acted in the interest of tenants, of renters, of working New Yorkers. And that's precisely why we're ramping up our efforts, right? Because, they won't act. And we know that politicians don't act out of benevolence. And, you know, we're never expecting, or I'm not certainly expecting them to act out of benevolence. They act because they're forced to act, because they've received enough pressure from their constituents, to move and act, in the interest of those people. And so, yeah, their response has been a non-response. It's not been a non-response. It's actually been an anti-renter, anti-working class response. You know, a 90-day eviction moratorium is not good enough. And even Senator Gennaris, who sponsored the bill to cancel rent for rent-stabilized and rent-controlled units in the city, you know, even that bill, it was not enough, but it was something. And he said, you know, it's absurd to only have a moratorium on evictions, because what happens on July 1st when housing courts reopen after the 90-day moratorium is lifted and landlords either rush to housing court to sue their tenants for non-payment? And then what's the court going to say? Okay, you owe 3 months of back rent plus this month. So you owe 3 months back rent and then July 1st rent. Like, if people, you know, Janara said, if people couldn't pay, you know, April rent, how does the state expect renters to be able to come up with 4 months rent on July 1st? Like, it's absurd. Like, just logically, it just falls apart, right? And, but, you know, this isn't something that the the politicians, you know, don't know. They know that this is the case, but they don't care. They are acting in the interest of the class that supports them and props them up and ensures a re-election. And we're organizing to put the pressure necessary for them to finally act and respond to the needs of their constituents, which is, you know, working class New Yorkers.
Yeah, I would just say Governor Andrew Cuomo has worked in housing for his entire career and always as a friend to developers and an enemy of tenants. He's been using this moment to his political advantage, obviously. He seems to have become America's sweetheart overnight. But behind the scenes of his press conferences, he's been making cuts to Medicaid during a pandemic. He's been rolling back bail reform, leaving thousands exposed to the virus in our jails and prisons. And he's been refusing, of course, to address the needs of tenants. And so we know that we need to really put the pressure on, because he's been treating it as a laughing matter so far. As Stella said, the 90-day eviction moratorium is, you know, it hardly even kicks the can down the road. And much, much more expansive action is needed to ensure that this crisis isn't compounded, that we don't have, you know, directly on the heels of the largest public health crisis of our lifetimes, the largest surge in homelessness in American history.
Well, let's get into May Day. I'm just curious if you can tell us what you expect to happen, because a lot of the articles that are being written, even in the business press, like I believe Bloomberg, I mean, they're saying that potentially thousands, if not more, people might join this thing. I'm just curious, what do you think is going to happen, and tell us about kind of like what's going into putting these plans into reality?
Yeah, I would direct people to the Housing Justice for All Coalition, who have released a pretty comprehensive rent strike toolkit. And they also have a pledge online at bit.ly/can'tpaymay. And that is for folks who cannot or will not pay the rent on May 1st. There are already thousands of signatures on the pledge, and we hope to see millions of people standing together to announce our intentions in not paying the rent. I mean, the truth is we know that millions of people won't pay the rent on May 1st. The question is, can we say that those people are coordinated and organized and working together, speaking with a collective voice in order to make collective demands? And so that's where I think the movement is the problem that the movement is working on right now, is organizing what could otherwise unfold as chaos into something meaningful and something, you know, directed at the people at the levers of power and you know, the people who could really do something about it. The people who, if they don't do something about it, will have, you know, an untold crisis on their hands, you know, even more so than they already do. And it'll be well understood that crisis has happened as a result of their inaction.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have much more to add to that. It's the difference between just, again, sitting in your apartment, being scared and nervous about what's to come because you can't pay, because you've been out of work for weeks, because unemployment hasn't hit, because you're one of the hundreds of thousands of people who don't qualify to receive a stimulus check. And, you know, not that $1,200 goes a long way anywhere, but certainly not here in New York. And, you know, it's the difference between being able to organize this crisis and chaos, so that we can end up on the other side of it with more, rather than less.
Well, for everybody that's listening to this, that's in a similar situation, what advice would you give them?
Well, definitely, you know, if you're in New York, go to bit.ly/can'tpaymay and sign the pledge. And join the thousands of New Yorkers who have already signed it and said, They are standing with each other and facing whatever comes next in this crisis together. You can access the Housing Justice for All organizing toolkit also at bit.ly/RRent, capital S and strike, and then capital NY, so Rent Strike New York, with a capital R, capital S, and then capital NY. And, you know, that's specific to New York, but as a toolkit to get started, it's an invaluable resource, so definitely tap into that. Talk to your neighbors, build mutual aid to help each other out. I mean, like at the very baseline, like just make sure that you speak to the people you live around, your neighbors, and help each other out. And seriously talk about what it would look like to organize yourselves, to protect yourselves, right? And again, you know, if you're still employed and wondering, well, you know, I can pay and I don't want to risk a non-renewal of my lease, you know, not to like scare people, but we are in an unprecedented moment and we don't know what's coming next. And even those of us who are still employed, like, you know, 16 million people applied for unemployment in the last 4 weeks. That is surely to grow exponentially in the weeks to come. And like I said, housing is the foundation to a healthy, you know, a healthy life. Everything else is jeopardized when your housing situation is jeopardized. And, you know, I think it's high time that we put housing and, you know, healthcare, at the front of, you know, human rights here in this country. And so I would say, check out those resources, talk to your neighbors, be open and honest and vulnerable with each other about your concerns. Build that trust that you need to go into whatever the next few months look like. Start there, you know, it starts really with a conversation, and being honest and open about where you're at.
Well, do you want to add anything else or convey anything? I know you all are at the epicenter of kind of all this stuff going on. I mean, not only of the rent strike, but also just the pandemic itself. Is there anything else you want to convey or talk about before we sign off?
Say really quick, because I don't think we have on this call just the demands that we're striking with on the state level. So we are demanding that Governor Cuomo cancel rent for every tenant in New York for the duration of the crisis. We are demanding a rent freeze to protect against landlords profiteering and trying to recoup lost revenue by raising the rents later. We're demanding that the 92,000 New Yorkers currently experiencing homelessness be permanently housed immediately. We know that there's more than enough vacant housing for everyone if we made our state-owned and state-subsidized units available. And we're demanding a significant reinvestment in public, nonprofit, and other social housing models. Not only to keep them afloat during this crisis, but also to strengthen and expand them going forward. You know, we know that housing is healthcare, and that those who are the most vulnerable in this moment are those without housing. And so as tenants, we strike in solidarity with the 92,000 New Yorkers experiencing homelessness as well, of course.
Yeah. No, thanks for sharing the demands. I know I realize now that we didn't put those forward. And also, you know, to add one last thing to that little bit is that we know that we're only as healthy and safe as the most vulnerable among us. And that's part of the demands that, you know, we are putting forward, or the platform that we're participating in here in New York, City and New York State. And then just to wrap it up, I know I already said this earlier, but I can't emphasize enough that there's no going back to normal. Like, normal's gone. The status quo is gone. Even though it sucked, even though it was insufficient, even though it left out a lot of people, millions of people, in this country, like, there's no going back to even that. And so on the other side of this, we're going to either end up with less than we have. We'll see the little that we've been able to cling on to in the last few decades be completely stripped away. Or we can come together and fight to make housing a human right, healthcare a human right. you know, look at all of the things that this crisis has exposed, the flaws in the system, and demand better from the system, demand a total overhaul of all of these things that prioritize profit over human life. And the only way that we're going to get that is if we're better organized than the people who, you know, the powers that be, because they're very well organized, and that's why they've been able to strip away everything that that previous generations had won. They are very well organized, and we need to match that organization so that we can win back the things that we've lost and make sure that we can hang on to the things that we still have.
I wrote this to start a fire. I wrote this in memory of Heather Heyer. Fire starter, throwing kerosene on the coals. For the white rose, rest in peace to Sophie Scholl. This for Liberatic, who fight against the fascists. The Idlewise pirates said, take this day to smash it. The swing kids as I zoom in Zoot suit jackets, along with the slurs who wanted Nazis and trash pits. I wrote this for Emma, who lit my soul's inner flame. This is for Ida, who taught us how to liberate. 43 group in the battle of Cable Street, who fought fascists in London, blood left their faces streaked. We rock against racism like the X-ray specs. We're looking for liberation, not paychecks. From Charlottesville to the Valley of Harama, I thought Killjoy told you there's no Nazis in Valhalla.
We never think about Heather but when we laugh or smile, because she often made people laugh. We love the sound of her laugh. A lot of us have videotapes.
We don't all have to sacrifice our lives. They tried to kill my child to shut her up. Well, guess what? You just magnified her.
Fascism is not to be debated, it is to be destroyed. The reason cops are hated is cause the Klan they employ. From the Trail of Tears to the streets of Ferguson, from Rikers to Pelican Bay, the state we're murdering. We're kicking fascists like St. Pauli, like when Ethiopia fought them with Holly. Lessons learned from Robeson to Chairman Fred. Solidarity, not charity, like Common Ground said. Just trying to find my way like Ellis a recluse. I'm looking for that strength that Ella Baker knew. Each bar is like John Brown cocking the hammer. We combat the propaganda like the breakfast from Panthers. It's for the CNT and the Mujeres Libres. I'm battling the state of myself, I'm in a fight this three-way. They should not pass, so Passeron is what we say. A place of killer P is what I'm telling the DJ.
I understood exactly what fascism was while I was there. And my intention was to go any place where I could help. I couldn't live with myself today if I hadn't gone then, knowing what happened.
Neo-fascists had their own ammunition, and this is very important to keep in mind, because the police for the most part pulled back. The next day, for example, of the 20 of us who were standing, many of them clergy, we would have been crushed like cockroaches if it were not for the anarchists and the anti-fascists who approached over 350 anti-fascists. We just had 20, and we singing This Little Light of Mine. You see, you know what I mean? So that
Antifa meaning anti-fascist.
The anti-fascist and the crucial role of the anarchists, because they saved our lives, actually. We would.
Yeah, so there's been a lot happening. The first thing we're going to touch on is these rallies that have been going on. There's been some interesting articles that have come out. I know you've read some. I listened to something that was on NPR the other day. It was produced by the New York Times. It's about 30 minutes. It's a podcast. It's looking at the various kind of dark money that's kind of goes back to the Tea Party that's helped finance some of this stuff, and kind of the players involved in setting up a lot of these protests. I know Jason Wilson at The Guardian also has a great article out that talks about not only some of the far right faces that have shown up to these, including like straight up neo-Nazis, but also just people connected like Betsy DeVos or the Koch brothers foundations that are helping to kind of guide these things. And essentially the picture that comes out is that you have a coming together of kind of moneyed interests that obviously want the economy to reopen. And they're using essentially the Trump movement or, you know, MAGA supporters as kind of like the shock troops to come out to these things. And then these demonstrations can then be reported on like Fox News. Trump can tweet about them. Obviously, he did that famously, liberate Minnesota. But again, like all of these kind of factors reinforce each other. But what have you been seeing? What's the big picture here?
Yeah, so there's what I would say are two threads of research going on right now. And some of these threads of research are happening on places like Reddit. There's actually it's called the Mass Move subreddit, which I'm not a person who goes on Reddit like almost ever. Most of what's on Reddit is garbage, but every once in a while, some people who really know what they're doing, like start a subreddit and start getting stuff going. So there's like the Mass Move subreddit, which is like a subreddit for people that are into like kind of lefty mass movement stuff, right? And one of the contributors on there was the person who started researching who was reserving the domain names that were showing up. So there's like all these domain names that fall under the reopen kind of domain name structure. So like reopen MN, which is like reopen Minnesota, right? And a bunch of them have been reserved really quickly over the last couple of weeks. And so usually when domain names get reserved in a highly organized way like that, it's because there's some sort of coordinated structure behind it. And so starting on this subreddit, people start doing research on that. That bounced over to a website called Krebs on Security, which is run by a former Washington Post reporter named Brian Krebs, who he does like news about the hacker world and stuff like that. It's actually a really good website if anyone's interested in checking that kind of stuff out. He's a really good researcher. But so from that one thread of research, we figured out a couple of things. The first is that most of these domain names have been reserved by one of two groups of people. The first group of people is actually random, like progressive-y lefty types who started noticing that the domain names are getting reserved, and they started buying a bunch of them themselves just to park them so they couldn't get used. And this is a thing that happens whenever a campaign kind of starts up, like a presidential campaign, anything, people go out and they buy a bunch of domain names. Like the opposition goes out and buys a bunch of domain names to deprive a candidate or a campaign from being able to use them, right? But by far, the bulk of these domain names have been reserved by established right-wing organizations. And those right-wing organizations fall into sort of three categories. The first is local Republican parties. So, you know, in doing research on some of the domains in places like Georgia, California, local county Republican parties are the ones that are reserving these domain names. And they're doing that seemingly in coordination with state Republican parties and then the national Republican Party. So the RNC as a national organization has started taking officially the position that coronavirus is not that bad and that really the restrictions should just go away. And, you know, maybe this was all just overblown, blah, 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 blah. Like the Republican Party has adopted the position that it is okay to demand human sacrifice for capitalism as an official position. And they have been, by all indications, encouraging state and local Republican operatives to reserve these domains to pop up websites to kind of foster these sort of demonstrations. There's also gun rights groups. And a lot of these gun rights groups are, you know, sort of well-established kind of state gun rights groups. So like Michigan, Minnesota, places like that, the domains have been reserved by gun rights organizations. Now, the gun rights organizations are interesting, though. So if you look at the specific organizations that are being talked about and you look at the people that run those organizations, the people that run those organizations aren't just like pro-Second Amendment wingnuts. They're well-connected Republican operatives. Many of them have connections to, in a very specific case in Michigan, to Betsy DeVos, to other very wealthy Republican donors. Then there's a third kind of category, which is, quote, grassroots conservative organizations. Now, why I put that in air quotes is because these organizations are groups like Freedom Works, right? Or, you know, the Michigan Conservative Coalition, or I think it's called, or Michigan Conservative Union. And these also are groups which are well-funded. Like Freedom Works is connected to the Koch brothers, right? Or they're run by people who have run state Republican parties before and are very well connected in Washington. And these groups all have a very, very, very deep history in engaging in AstroTurf campaigns. So what an AstroTurf campaign is, for people that don't know, is a campaign which is funded by moneyed interest, which uses professional marketing and high coordination across local areas to make it look like there's a local grassroots movement popping up in a bunch of different places all at the same time. So the classic example in sort of modern history is the Tea Party movement. If you look at the Tea Party, and there were some really fascinating studies done by like sociologists and stuff sort of as the Tea Party ground on, what was discovered was that initially the first Tea Party demonstrations were actually mostly individual conservative activists showing up. Now, they were being organized by these kind of official organizations, specifically Freedom Works, but a lot of the people that were coming were grassroots conservative activists, like people that were active in like anti-choice movements or like from the religious right or something like that, or they were like pro-capitalist libertarians or whatever. But as the Tea Party ground on, so by the time they got to the final kind of, quote, big rally, so big being over 100 people, right, in Washington, D.C., a reporter, I forget which outlet, had gone down to that rally and actually asked people whether or not they worked for these organizations. And they found out that over 50% of the people that were there were employees of, or were there on their own volition, but are in their daily life employees of these same conservative organizations, or they're getting stipends to be local organizers or whatever. All the buses that went down to those rallies in DC for the Tea Party were paid for by Freedom Works, right? So like there's no actual real grassroots initiative. There's grassroots anger and frustration that wasn't going to mobilize, that is then mobilized by these organizations, right? So that's kind of the first sort of phase of what we're seeing, right? So you know, Vox kind of broke this down really well into five parts. And I think I want to go over these kind of five pieces really quickly in order, because they sort of form a really interesting system. So the first is there is actually legitimate frustration here, right? Being stuck in your house sucks. Being stuck in your house as like an urban dwelling millennial still sucks, but at least we're like connecting with each other over the internet and stuff and figuring out ways to do things. If you are a baby boomer in a rural area, you've largely been cut off from everybody, right? Both through technological illiteracy, but also just a basic lack of just the number of people you actually have connections with, because you're just around fewer people. And so there is a legitimate frustration here. Like people are feeling pent up and frustrated and stuck in their houses and they don't really know what's going on. And that's legitimate, right? I think a lot of us feel that day to day. I know I do, right? Like I totally want to go hang out with my friends again and I miss a lot of people. And that's frustrating. So there is legitimate frustration here, but that legitimate frustration wasn't going to manifest itself in demonstrations. That frustration's been there from the beginning, and it had never manifested itself publicly. So stage one of any of these AstroTurf campaigns is that there is actual frustration somewhere, to some degree. Now, polling has shown that the vast, vast, vast majority of Americans, like over 80%, are frustrated but comfortable abiding with the restrictions. 72% of Americans have even said that they are going to voluntarily still kind of self-quarantine and maintain social distancing even after this is all over, even after the formal governmentally imposed restrictions are gone, for very practical scientific reasons, right? There's no cure, there's no vaccine, there's no idea of how many people are infected, so there's no reason to trust going outside, right? So there is frustration, but most of that frustration was never going to manifest itself publicly. So these organizations swoop in and they create the infrastructure and they do the outreach to create these kind of public manifestations, most of which outside of Michigan. So the demonstration in Michigan was large, but outside of Michigan, most of these are very small. The demonstration in a place like Ohio only had a couple dozen people, right? And that's kind of more typically what we were seeing, is a couple dozen to maybe 100. It was like Texas and Michigan had big ones, but generally they were very small. So the second step of any of these AstroTurf campaigns is to build the idea that there's a wide-scale movement happening, right? That it's not just some fringy people showing up in the streets sponsored by formal right-wing organizations who themselves get funding from the ultra-wealthy, but that there's actually broad frustration that's autonomously manifesting on a grassroots level in the semi-coordinated way, and that that's an actual legitimate political frustration, actual legitimate political movement. Now, in this case, all of that is happening over Fox News and OAN, right? One American News and stuff like that, like right-wing news. And what they're doing is they're perpetuating this idea that these demonstrations are huge when they're not. They're doing things like minimizing the presence of far right wing groups like neo-Nazis and militias and saying they're not actually present. That's all a myth. And they're playing news about these things ad nauseum constantly to encourage people that are watching those channels to also support these things, right? That to give them the sense that they are a part of something bigger than themselves or bigger than a small group of fringy people. And the goal of that is, you know, twofold. The first is to build the idea of political legitimacy. So what they're trying to say on Fox is this is not just a bunch of Nazis and conspiracy theorists and militia people. These are normal Republicans, and this is a legitimate position that's held by a plurality of people, right? Which is not true. Like, that's not the case. The second goal is, of course, profit. So Fox News for a long time, specifically Fox News, no one needs to talk about OAN because OAN is essentially right-wing wingnuts on a cable news channel. But Fox is at least ostensibly a legitimate news organization. They themselves have waffled back and forth from saying that this is a conspiracy to saying that this is real to telling people that they don't have to care about social distancing to telling people that they do. And they do this, they switch their position amongst their sort of opinion staff based on what they feel is going to build them the most capital and get them, like political capital, and get them the most viewers, which generates actual capital, which generates profit, right? So the third step of this is that there is no actual widespread support, and that can be seen by polling, which leads to sort of the fourth step. Right. So the fourth step here is what we're starting to understand these demonstrations as being used for. And this is the really important part. So I think one of the big questions that has been asked so far is why. So I think for a lot of people, there's an assumption that there is behind the scenes coordination going on. And there's an assumption that that coordination is happening, by organizations that are funded by the ultra wealthy and the very well connected. And that's all true. But I think that there's been some confusion about why. And it's really simple. The administration has been working through a process in which first they tried to deny the severity of what was going on. That didn't work because, you know, it's a virus and viruses don't listen to politicians. A bunch of people got sick really quick. It got completely out of control. There was no testing. There's no equipment, right? The entire healthcare system is imploding on itself. And none of us still, even now, 2.5 months into this thing, have any idea how bad it is, right? So the White House strategy has been, let's displace responsibility down to the states and specifically target Democratic governors. And so if you look at the places where the largest demonstrations were, they were in places where either the state is run by Democrats and it's a swing state like Michigan, or in states where the Republican Party is losing control, like Texas. So in Texas right now, what Tom DeLay called the permanent Republican majority is collapsing. And Democrats are actually putting Texas in play for the presidential election and are pretty close to actually in polling being ahead of Trump in the presidential election leading up to November, right? And so these demonstrations are very specifically targeted in order to either build energy amongst Trump's base or to demonize the Democratic governor. And so in places where you saw bigger demonstrations, that's a lot of what the messaging was, right? Other places where you saw smaller demonstrations, those didn't get press coverage. Like, you don't hear about demonstrations in North Dakota. You don't hear about demonstrations in a place like Georgia, right? Although they happened. But you do hear about them in a place like Louisiana, which is run by a Democrat now, Michigan, which is run by not only a Democrat, but a very likely vice presidential candidate, or Texas, where they're starting to lose the Republican majority. Right. And so this is about displacing focus. And we'll get into a little bit about this kind of like Trumpian strategy of what happens after displacing focus fails. But before we get there, we should also look at the fifth sort of step of this process so far, which is that none of this is actually working. And so because most Americans are willing to abide by the restrictions themselves and will continue to do so in the future, what's starting to happen is that blame is starting to land firmly on Trump and Republican governors that are sort of following the Trump line. So specifically Ron DeSantis in Florida, Brian Kemp in Georgia, places like that, right? I forget the name of the governor of Tennessee, but in Tennessee, right? And people are starting to blame those people. So now this leads to what's happening right now, which I think is really important. So the demonstrations happened, and then they kind of went away. It's not like we're seeing follow-ups, right? We're not seeing people in large numbers show up online and support these people. That in fact, what's happened is that the general response in public has been, look at these wingnuts. They're all going to catch coronavirus, and I'm going to stay as far away from them as I possibly can, right? And so the strategy was an attempt to displace focus, but it failed, right? And what will become very interesting kind of going into this next phase is to see how these well-funded, well-connected Republican organizations and conservative groups that are funding and building the infrastructure for these things, how they then respond, right? Because with the Tea Party, they had more public support than they have now, right? And if all of this is about ensuring that Trump can blame someone else for his mistakes, therefore ensuring they doesn't have to take a political hit when it comes up to reelection, this strategy is very distinctly failing. And you can see this on the White House level. So from the White House, they talked about for a week, look at these demonstrations, people need to liberate Michigan, blah, 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 blah. And they caught a lot of pushback from that. Because at the same time they were saying that, they were also saying, here are the reasons why social distancing makes sense. Here are the official CDC guidelines that we just updated. You know, states should be, so they were contradicting themselves.
Well, Trump even said, he's like, well, what I saw was that people were 6 feet apart, which is just obviously complete bullshit. I
mean, obviously not true. Yeah. And so the strategy fell apart. And so what they've been trying to do is they've been trying to do two things. So the first is they've pretty much given up on rewriting history, right? So the last episode we did, we talked a lot about how the Trump administration is trying to rewrite the history of the coronavirus and how they at this point have functionally failed to do so. They've also failed to place blame on Democratic governors. That if you look at the polling, Trump's approval ratings are dropping. Trump's approval ratings in relation to the coronavirus are really dropping. The approval ratings of people like Brian Kemp and Ron DeSantis are also falling through the floor. And the only people that are doing good in approval polls right now are the same Democratic governors they tried to demonize and like moderate Republican governors that are also going along with the restrictions, right? People like Mike DeWine in Ohio or Andrew Cuomo in New York, like their approval ratings are shooting through the roof. And so the White House has done two things to try and switch gears, right? The first is that they have now decided that it makes sense to blame the same Republican governors that Trump was being a champion for just last week. So just today and yesterday, he started talking about how Brian Kemp, like lowering the restrictions in Georgia was a big mistake and how Ron DeSantis needs to put more restrictions in place and blah, 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 blah. And he's like pushing blame onto Republican governors in order to shield himself from having to take responsibility, right? The second thing he's done is claim that he was going to, quote, ban immigration. And we'll talk about that a little bit in a second. But essentially, what this can show us very clearly at this point is that Trump's strategies tend to work in three phases. So the first phase is to do a thing that, you know, is loosely based on Trump just saying something, like floating an idea. I'm going to ban Muslims from coming into the United States. I'm going to, you know, push another tax break. I'm going to do this. And he'll float the idea on Twitter and they'll kind of see what the reaction is. Generally, if they get a good reaction from the base, they push through with the policy right away, right? When that policy then fails, the next step of their strategy is to push the blame somewhere else. So child separation is a really great example of this. Okay, they imposed a child separation policy, which was entirely conceived of by Stephen Miller. And they pushed that out to the public, and the public is horrified, justifiably. So then what they do is they go, oh, but that's not our policy. That was already implied in the Obama administration's immigration policy. And they pushed that line for a really long time, where they said, oh, this is just failures in the Department of Homeland Security, which cost Kirstjen Nielsen her job, right? She resigned because she took the blame for screwing up, essentially, the process of reuniting children with their parents, right? Which wasn't her fault. It was a fault of the child separation policy, but she took the hit for that, so she resigns. That also doesn't make the blowback go away. So then the next step is to distract attention. And the way that they do that is they do it by saying something completely over the top and ridiculous. And so let's look at that in this context. The first thing Trump does is go, this isn't that bad. We don't need to really care. America's great. And we're just going to block people from coming in from overseas, from China and stuff, and Europe. And that'll just stop the virus. And by the way, even if it does get here, it'll be gone by the end of the spring anyways. That doesn't work. You know, there's a number of other things he pushed in this situation, like, oh, look at this new drug that people can take and things like that, right? None of those things work. So the next thing he does, and this is the phase that we were in last week, was trying to push blame onto other people. So Jared Kushner's, quote, task force starts saying, oh, these governors don't actually need as many ventilators as they say, and they're just not being effective at dealing with the crisis. And, you know, this is all their fault. And this is the fault specifically of Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, and Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, and Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan. And look at that. And they try to blame Democrats. That failed. So then they get all their supporters ginned up to show up to try and reinforce that line. That failed. Then they tried to blame Republican governors. That failed. So now what they're doing is they're trying to push a really extreme position. We're going to ban immigration, right? As a way to defray attention. The problem is that in the past, when they've done this, and we talked about this a little bit over the last couple of episodes, but in the past, that strategy has essentially relied on the fact that the right wing has a very short memory. If you really look at the right-wing media ecosystem, it's all about pushing whatever the outrage of the day is onto their viewers and getting them all riled up about it. When a week from now, that won't even be a thing anyone will be paying attention to, right? So, like, I don't know if people can even remember 5 or 6 years ago, but 5 or 6 years ago, the big thing on Fox News was the war against Christmas, right? Everyone's trying to destroy people saying Merry Christmas, things like that, right? And it's just a thing to give to their base to get them all riled up and keep them engaged, right? To keep them engaged in the discourse.
you know, as you mentioned, the Tea Party experience, I think there's that to mention, but then there's also, we should remember the March 2017 pro-Trump rallies that happened as well. Remember, there was a lot of anti-fascist organizing against those. But I mean, it was even coming out that like bots and different things had, you know, a hand in helping to like push those.
Yep.
And I want to make clear, it's not like the people that are coming out to these demonstrations are not like real people, or they're not real Trump supporters, or they're not grassroots.
Yeah, they legitimately believe these things. Like, that's true.
Right. But, right?
They legitimately believe this stuff.
But it's that the online infrastructure and like the setting up a lot of the Facebooks, and we've seen this time and time again. I mean, like the creation of, you know, so and so for Trump, XYZ for Trump. I mean, this is part and parcel of how they've built this campaign around.
Well, and the money. So, like, I don't know how many people who have listened to this show, who do listen to this show, have ever organized a large rally. Like, I have, right? I mean, I've definitely been involved in organizing rallies of 5,000 people plus. It's expensive. Like, permits are expensive. If you decide to go get permits, sound equipment is expensive. Outreach is expensive. Buses are expensive. Like, all of that's expensive. Thousands and thousands of dollars to throw a rally that size. It's a very expensive proposition. The money for all of that, the organizing of the logistics for all of that, that's what's being provided by these organizations that are well-funded, well-connected. And the coordination across local areas, right?
I just want to point out that we can see this, you know, reality play out within, you know, the Trump presidency lifetime, not just within, you know, the Tea Party example. The other thing I want to point out, too, is just stuff like this is funny because it really exposes, you know, these George Soros tropes for what they are, but also the fact that, like, the reality of these tropes really do live on the far right. I mean, but also I think that, you know, the way that the media reports on them, I mean, as many people have pointed out, you know, what have we been seeing the past, you know, month or so? We've been seeing wave after wave of demonstrations outside of ICE detention facilities, outside of prisons, demanding that people be let go. We've seen wildcat strikes, just wave after wave of actions happening in different, you know, workplaces again and again. We're seeing, you know, a massive wildcat strike at the University of California. We're seeing like all these different kinds of actions take place. We're seeing the rent strike pop off. I mean, have we seen any sort of like comparative, you know, coverage from the media either on the so-called left or the right? No, not at all. And that's because the interests of the demonstrations don't align with the corporate media whatsoever, but the interest of getting people to go back to work, to reopening the state, obviously does align with, you know, much of the corporate media, and especially the conservative media that aligns with Trump. I mean, it completely lines up with, you know, getting him reelected, reopening the economy, and backing the Republican Party.
Right. Well, and so usually the way that the strategy works is based in the same sort of methodology that the right-wing media uses in general. So Trump says a thing. It doesn't fly. He tries to displace blame. That doesn't fly. And so what he does then is he does something really extreme. And the point of that really extreme thing is to create a rally point for his supporters and a rally point for his opponents. And what that does is it focuses attention on the extremity of the ridiculous thing, rather than focusing on the reality of what happened before that. And what that does is it creates generally a very short-term memory politically, that it is very difficult for any of us to even take an inventory of all the really awful stuff that has happened as a part of this administration, right? Like, I'm in conversations with my friends all the time, and someone will mention a really awful thing, and I'll be like, oh, I forgot that even happened, because it was like 2 years ago. Right. The problem is that generally the right wing media is successful at doing that because the issues that they're pushing as the outrage of the day aren't things that actually impact anyone directly. So take the war on Christmas, or even more, why don't we take the mythologies of Christians being murdered in the Middle East, which is a really common sort of right wing trope, that Christians all over the Middle East are being wholesale murdered by just Muslims in general, right? And it's one of these lines that's been pushed by people like Pam Geller and, you know, Michelle Malkin and people like this, right? The reality is that that's not happening, right? I mean, yeah, ISIS murders Christians, but they murder everybody. Like, it's not actually happening that Christians are being targeted specifically in the Middle East. But nobody who watches Fox News or gets their primary information from Fox News would know that. They don't know anybody in the Middle East. They don't look for other sources of information that would contradict that. They just believe it because they identify with the problem, right? The war on Christmas was very similar. We saw this in the late 90s with things like prayer in schools, you know, stuff like this. Like, these aren't things that really impact people all that directly. They're very abstract issues that are thought about on a global scale, or even like the Tea Party's response to bailouts, where, I mean, we were talking about this before the show, before we started recording, but a big element of the Tea Party movement was rejecting the corporate bailouts that happened after the 2008 financial crisis. But it's not like those rejections were grounded in economics or an understanding of job markets or an understanding of capitalism. They were grounded in an abstract idea that in a free market, people should be allowed to fail, right? Which wasn't something that actually impacted any of these people directly, because they weren't the ones that owned businesses or were major investors in banks. But the people that were organizing the demonstrations, even though they were people who were benefiting from the bailouts, saw a political imperative in both benefiting from the bailouts and challenging the bailouts at the same time, right? So there was legitimate anger that was abstract, but the people organizing that had very direct interest in what they were organizing, right? And so in this case, though, the coronavirus impacts people directly. And one of the outcomes of that has been that people have a longer-term memory about what Trump has said in the process of this crisis. And you can see this in, again, basic opinion polling. So before the crisis, it was pretty normal to see an opinion poll which would say something like, 70 to 75% of Trump supporters are willing to believe what Trump says over all other information. Okay? And that's really disturbing, but it was a reality that Trump had successfully delegitimized all other sources of information except himself, which, you know, as John Oliver once pointed out, that's the media strategy for North Korea. Just go to the leader for all of your information, right? But all of those issues are very abstract. Even things like the Muslim ban were very abstract, or things like preventing illegal immigration were very abstract. That didn't really impact most of the people that were very supportive of those policies, right? Coronavirus is different, though. And so what we're watching is that Trump's reliability rating, so the amount of people that believe what he says about coronavirus, is below 50%. And like significantly below 50% in most polls. It's down around 30%. And what that means is even a lot of his own supporters are remembering things like, I thought you told us we didn't have to care about this. Why are you telling us we now have to abide by social distancing? Wait, last week you told us we had to abide by social distancing. So why are you saying now that the protests against social distancing are legitimate? Right? Oh, well, you said that the protests against social distancing were legitimate. So now why are you criticizing Ron DeSantis for not putting in place social distancing? This is the problem. So in the past, Trump has been able to switch positions in such a way where he states a thing, goes through this process where he states a thing, gets rejected. He tries to build up his supporters and defray responsibility. That gets rejected. He tries to do a really extreme thing. And when he does the really extreme thing in the past, everyone has lost focus on the original thing he said. And then 2 to 3 weeks later, he'll come out and immediately just directly contradict that initial thing that he said that kickstarted that whole process. And in the past, most people have been willing to just kind of let that go because they don't even remember what the original thing was by that point. This is different, though. Americans are developing a political memory. And in that political memory, they're starting to realize that the administration right now is pretty much trying to do one thing and one thing only. And that is do everything that it can to not take responsibility for the fact that the economy is crashing. Because their only argument for re-election was, look at how great the economy is. And now they don't have that argument because we're up around 20% unemployment. It will probably climb up to 30%. We're looking at GDP shrinkage of 15 to 25% just this quarter, right? We're looking at a catastrophic financial crisis that is bigger than the Great Depression.
Yeah.
Right.
And we should also point out that COVID deaths have also been exploding. I mean, we're talking about like over a 9/11 or double a day. Amount of people just in the United States. I mean, just in the United States. And that's not to mention the amount of COVID cases that are being reported, which are doubling and getting larger. But I mean, the amount of deaths is really staggering when you think about it. I mean, like, we're talking thousands of people per day. I mean, I know we've talked about this before, but I mean, you know, this is getting to the point now where this is touching people. Like, this is touching people's lives. I mean, I know we've said before that, like, this is going to end up, you know, everybody's going to know somebody or, you know, have some connection. And it's starting to get that way. And,
we are officially the global epicenter of coronavirus. And, like, one of the ways that Trump has tried to defray that attention. So it's not just with the immigration ban. He tried to do this last week with the whole World Health Organization thing by, quote, defunding the WHO. Right. By saying that they were, quote, covering up information about what was going on in China. And then they got rebuked internationally for that position and by most Americans who also think that that position was really stupid. But I think we have a clear indication that this is about Trump's argument about the economy in the wording of how they framed the immigration ban. And we'll get into what the immigration ban is and isn't in a second. But right now I want to focus on the language around it. So the language around the immigration ban was really fascinating because it wasn't actually about these people are coming in from overseas and that's why we're getting sick, right? If that were going to be the argument, you know, that wouldn't get dealt with by preventing people from having visas. That would be prevented by stopping anyone from coming here at all, which is not what they're doing, right? What they did say, though, is we need to prevent foreign workers from coming to the United States so when the economy opens, Americans can get jobs. Now, there's a lot of problems with that argument outside of the fact that it's just spectacularly racist and doesn't actually understand anything about how economics works. But there's a basic problem with that argument, which is that it's not that people are out of work because they're competing for jobs. It's that people are out of work because the economy was already weak going into this crisis, and the crisis just amplified the weaknesses in the economy and caused it to crash. So it's not just that the economy crashed because of the virus. I think we have to be very clear about that. The economy was in the process of already crashing slowly because of companies and individuals over-leveraging themselves on debt. Now, individuals are doing that to pay bills. Companies are doing that to buy their own stock to drive their stock prices up so they can borrow more money to buy their stock to drive their stock prices up. This process has been going on for about 30 years, right? But the economy was already unsustainable, and it was one shock away from crashing, and most economists agree with that position. It just happened to be that the shock was coronavirus. It could have been anything. It could have been natural disasters. It could have been a really bad fire season this year. Anything that would have impacted the ability of corporations to pay off the extreme amounts of debt that they've been taking on ever since the Trump tax breaks and the lowering of interest rates over the last couple of years. Anything that would have impacted that would have triggered a crisis. It just happened to be coronavirus. So the language around the immigration ban is based on the assumption that American workers are out of work because foreign workers are taking their jobs. Now, why would they make that argument? Because it's demonstrably untrue. Right. We can look at this and say, well, employment numbers are already going down before the crisis started. Now people are getting laid off. Right. So the amount of jobs that are being added to the economy was already shrinking by the time the crisis started. So why would he be blaming immigrants? Well, it's really, really simple. And it ties in with everything else we've been talking about. This is all about him trying to figure out a way to not have to be responsible in the eyes of the public for the crashing of the economy. Right. Again, this comes back to his one argument that he has. Because even if you look at most Republicans, like most Trump-supporting Republicans, the reality of their position on immigration is simple. They are making an assumption that, quote, illegal immigration is, A, costing them jobs, which is untrue. Most jobs in the U.S. have been lost over the last 40 years, have been lost to automation, or outsourcing, which outsourcing is a very small part of that compared to automation, like more than 70% of net job loss since the 70s is because of automation. But his supporters are making the assumption that A, illegal immigration, like people crossing the border without documents, or overstaying visas or whatever, is responsible for the loss of jobs in the United States and B, that all of that comes from south of the border, right? And so the assumption itself is racist and entirely divorced from reality. But what Trump is banking on is that people will say, okay, cool, what you did is you cut off work visas, right? We'll get into the specifics of this in a second. What you did was you said you were going to ban immigration. He's hoping his supporters assume immigration comes from south of the border, and that they will then say, like, retreat back to the position that many of them had in 2016 when they voted for him, which was, as long as we stop people from coming from south of the border, then we can save the economy. But if we can't do that, then it's the people coming from south of the border that are to blame for the economy crashing. That's what Trump is hoping. All of his other arguments to try and not have to take responsibility for the financial crisis that's happening right now, based on their own lack of preparation around the pandemic, all of those other arguments have failed. Right? All the arguments about excessive restrictions have failed because he himself has contradicted them. All of the arguments about, you know, foreign workers have failed because Americans are losing jobs because of the crisis now. Right? So, you know, all the arguments about the fragility of the economy, and him saying, oh, look, the economy's not fragile, have failed because every single economist is coming out and saying, look, the economy is incredibly fragile. And so now what he's trying to do is he's trying to retreat back to this sort of connection that his supporters make between undocumented immigrants and economic crisis, which isn't an actual connection. The problem is, though, is that most Republicans in polling, most Trump-supporting Republicans, don't actually want to ban immigration. They want an immigration system which involves a bunch of legality. They want to limit immigration from south of the border because they are racist, right? But they don't want to actually stop all immigration. And there's a very basic reason for that. Over the last 20 to 30 years, there have been a lot of people moving to the United States from overseas. Mostly everybody in the U.S., whether you live in an urban area or a rural area or a suburban area, knows somebody or works with somebody or routinely interacts with somebody who came from overseas. And many of those people came legally. They came on work visas and student visas and stuff like that, right? A lot of those people are also now undocumented because they've overstayed those visas. And so we can see this early on in the ICE raids. When they were detaining brown people, most Republicans were okay with that. When they started detaining, you know, brown people that they knew, they weren't okay with that all of a sudden, right? That was their friend. That was their neighbor. All of a sudden, they got a personal connection to what was going on, and their position changed slightly. What has never happened, though, so far, is that Republicans and Trump-supporting Republicans have gone full-blown into the "we're just going to ban immigration" position. And so this, what we can see this as, is a Hail Mary, right? This is Trump taking one of his last possible options to defray responsibility, so he doesn't have to take responsibility during the re-election campaign. So then it's important to actually talk about what the immigration ban is. So he tweets out, I'm going to ban immigration. I'm going to sign an executive order to ban immigration. They elaborate on this during a press conference where they say, we're going to sign an executive order to ban immigration, to give American workers a chance to get jobs, right? Now, constitutionally, this will never fly. The only reason that Trump is even able to do this at all is because they declared a national emergency about coronavirus. And that does give the president more power, right, under a national emergency to do things related to the crisis. So to be able to put this position in place, they would have to make the argument that, A, immigration caused the crisis, not travel, not Americans traveling overseas, not people from overseas coming to the U.S., but actual people going through the visa process, coming to the United States legally, and being immigrants, that caused the pandemic. And there's zero evidence that that's the case. The second argument that they would have to make is, by banning legal immigration, we will be able to stop or significantly impact the crisis. Again, not travel. Because the way that this is laid out is for 60 days, the U.S. government will not issue green cards, essentially. You can still get a work visa. You can still get a student visa. You can still come over on a guest worker program. But what you can't do is actually get a green card.
And to be clear, a green card is something that basically says that you're allowed to stay in the country forever,
whether or not you have a job, right? So, like, green cards renew after a period of time. But to get a green card is the first step towards becoming a citizen. right? So the people that come here on work visas don't necessarily have green cards. They have a work visa, and they're allowed to be here because they have a work visa, right? Students don't have green cards, most of them. They're here on student visas. Like, they're allowed to come here to study, right? People in guest worker programs, which a lot of people that come from south of the border that work in the farming industry are under guest worker programs, they also don't have green cards necessarily. That most of them are coming temporarily to the United States to perform a job, and then they're going back home, right? None of those people are impacted. Travel from overseas for business isn't impacted. Shipping from overseas isn't impacted. The actual things that caused the transfer of the virus from outside the U.S. to inside the U.S. aren't impacted at all. But in the courts, they're going to have to make the argument that legal immigration, like people getting green cards and going through the citizenship process, is both to blame for the crisis, and that by eliminating that, we will end the crisis. There's no way to make that argument, right? This will never fly in the courts. But essentially what they just did was Trump signed an executive order under the national emergency saying that for the next 60 days and potentially extended beyond that, the U.S. government will not issue green cards. That's all. That's not what they framed it as. They framed it as an immigration ban. And so they've already started getting pushback from this by Republicans who are sitting there going, look, you can't just ban legal immigration. That this whole time their argument has been, we want to push immigration into a legal process. That we want to end illegal immigration and encourage legal immigration. That's been the argument. That has not been the reality. And so I think for a lot of people, there's starting to be an awakening happening now where they're starting to go, this thing that he just did makes no sense. So why is he doing it? Not only does it make no sense, a lot of his supporters don't even support it. So what's going on here? And I think the only way that we can make sense of all of this is to make sense of it through the lens of the protests that were sponsored by established, well-funded right-wing organizations failed to distract attention and responsibility away from the Trump administration. That other techniques that Trump used to distract responsibility have also failed. That things he has said in the past are starting to catch up to him because people are remembering what's going on. And so the thing that he thinks he needs to do is do the most extreme possible thing to get people to pay attention to something else. And the reality is that from what I've seen over the last few days since he's announced this, that hasn't worked. People are still paying attention to what's going on with coronavirus. People are still not listening to anything Trump has to say because he's lost all his legitimacy. And what that means isn't just that he is going to take a significant political hit for the coronavirus. It's that the entirety of Trumpian communication strategy is breaking down completely. And I think for a lot of us, we were wondering for a long time, what was going to be the moment in which people remembered that literally 2 weeks before this, he said exactly the opposite thing that he's saying right now. When was that moment going to come? And it seems like this is the moment. And this is the moment because it touches people directly. Because if people listen to the wrong information and go outside, they could get sick and die. And most people, outside of the ones showing up at these protests, most people are not willing to sacrifice that, even Republicans. And what that all adds up to is that right now, they're not going to be able to save the economy from itself. That's impossible. They're already negotiating a whole nother bailout because that small business fund that they had set up 3 weeks ago is already out of money. And they would need, by some estimates, 5 to 10 times that amount that they put into the original fund, which was, I think, something like $500 million. They would need 5 to 10 times that amount to get the economy through the next month. Just the next month. And that's just for small businesses. That doesn't count medium-sized businesses or large businesses. It doesn't count individuals who right now can barely buy food, a lot of them. That doesn't count any of that, right? That the reality is that for the American economy to survive over the next 18 months would require more money than there is available to make that happen. That we would need, again, as I said a couple of weeks ago, the majority of the world's liquid capital just to keep the American economy afloat. And that doesn't count any of the other large economies in the world, many of which are also on the verge of default and are seeing significant drops in economic activity, right? That is a reality. so far all of Trump's strategies to distract attention away from that reality, or to focus that reality on the domestic economic situation, or to try and distract attention and blame other people, all of those attempts have failed. And so for the first time, we can actually say that Trump's campaign strategy has broken down. And I think that that's a major milestone. As a major milestone for very demonstrable reasons. If we look at polling in a place like Michigan, which was really key to him winning in the Electoral College in 2016, he's getting trounced right now in the election. He's losing by 8 to 10 points, depending on the poll. And so we have to see all of what's been going on with these demonstrations and all of what's been going on with things like immigration bans and, you know, cutting off funding to the World Health Organization, all this stuff, as a frantic attempt by the Trump administration and associated well-connected, well-funded right-wing organizations to try and, by any means possible, salvage the possibility of a re-election. Because right now he is losing, and he's losing worse and worse and worse every single day. And the reality is that it's not like the Biden campaign has been out there doing a lot of work. They've essentially vanished from public consciousness. That, as an article in The Atlantic said, I think it was 3 weeks ago, we are at a point in American history where all Joe Biden has to do to win the election is be alive. That's it. He doesn't have to campaign. He doesn't have to do anything. He just has to stay living through the November election. Like, that's literally it. And right now, he would win that election just being a living thing with a pulse.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.